This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hello?
Hello?
Aisha.
Hey.
You are the girl that I never heard. Aisha.
I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji.
I'm Gene Demby, and this is Code Switch.
From NPR, and that person we're serenading with Another Bad Creation's 1990 hit, Aisha, is the one, the only...
Aisha Roscoe, and I cover the White House for NPR.
Do you know the rap, though?
I don't know it, no. Ronnie, Bobby, Ricky, and Mike, Chris, Margaret, Dave, bro.
This is how y'all start all the NPR politics podcasts, don't worry. I'm sure.
Pretty much.
If you listen to NPR's politics podcast or NPR at all, you know Aisha Roscoe.
Aisha has spent the last 4 years covering Donald Trump and his administration. So we asked her, what was it like at this time during the last transition back in 2017?
What it was just very chaotic. There was a question at that point in time whether Trump would even allow the press to stay in the White House, because technically there's no law that we have to be there. And there's no law that he has to have a pool of reporters travel with him everywhere. That's just a norm. And so there was this idea that he would just kick us out.
Aisha told us that at the beginning of Trump's official start as president, she recalls being at the White House for an event. And when it was done, she says Trump dismissed the press pool, then called them back again and said a few more things, dismissed them, only to call them back again.
He seemed to be realizing on that like second day in office that he could just call the press whenever he wanted. He had this captive audience. And so I realized at that point that he would never kick the press out because he loved that attention.
So he had a captive audience, but you know what I mean? Like, what was it like being in Trump's captive audience as a Black woman journalist? That's what we talked to Aisha about on this episode of Code Switch, the very last episode of the Trump presidency. I feel like I'm jinxing something.
And we are talking to you on Monday, January 18th, 2021, 2 days before Joe Biden is set to be sworn in as president of the United States. Did you think that maybe things might have slowed down for you at this point in the game? Did you think this is where we'd be?
I definitely thought that things would be much slower right now, or I hope they would. I think it was a hope. I guess I should say it was a hope. It was a wish. It was a dream. And it did not come true.
So if things were to work out the way you had hoped, wished, and dreamed for them to have worked out by this time in the Trump beat, what would your life be like?
Well, normally what happens with a president who is no longer going to be president, a lame duck, things really quiet down. And it's not the fast pace, got to get this done, this is important breaking news. It's just kind of like, this is history, this is what happened.
A little bit of housekeeping.
Yeah, it's like housekeeping. It's not front of mind because generally it's the person that's coming in. That's where everyone's attention is. But that is not obviously what happened in this situation.
Oh, yeah, gift for understatement. So just in the past 2 weeks, we've seen obviously an insurrection at the Capitol building, you know, by Trump supporters, urged on by Donald Trump. Donald Trump said he was going to come to the inauguration on Wednesday. And he became the first president in the history of the United States to be impeached twice. So what has it been like on your beat, like, to cover this over the last couple of weeks?
Just over the last couple of weeks, what it's been like?
Yeah, just since the...
I mean, it's not even like, I will say the last few weeks have been really kind of like a final, like, traumatic thing happening, like, and scary. Like, there are all these moments in covering Trump where it feels like you really don't know what's about to go down. And this seemed like the final moment of that. I mean, this past year has been intense. He got coronavirus. Like, we found that out at 1 a.m.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, he got coronavirus. Yeah. and he got, you know, had to rush off to the hospital. And so these are the things you're thinking, like, there have been so many moments where it's like, what happens next? What comes out of this? 2 weeks left. I thought we wouldn't have had that. I thought we had passed that point, but we weren't. Like, there was going to be one more, and this was going to be the one that really topped everything else, because it was the
But we
the
have
most
no
damaging.
Idea how Wednesday's going to go.
We don't.
In light of January 6th.
We don't. And that's the other scary thing, is that it's ongoing.
You know, a lot of people have talked about this past month of events being upsetting. Yes. Surprising. Not so much. Donald Trump has been stirring up all of these white racial grievances since before he was even in office. So, having reported on the presidency for the last 4 years, what's your take on that? That upsetting yes, surprising no.
I mean, it surprised me, not because Trump hadn't already been stirring this pot, but to actually see it come together. Like, he had been lighting matches for a very long time, and I had seen the matches, but he had seen they hadn't ignited completely. I guess it's like you're watching something for 4 years. He's come out of everything, impeached, the first impeachment, the Russia investigation. He's had all these rallies. He's said all this wild stuff. He's attacked all these people, and yet it hasn't gone to the place of really no return.
Mm-hmm.
So much has happened over the last few years when it comes to race in particular. So we just want to take you, Aisha, back to a moment that a lot of people may have forgotten by now. This was something President Trump said way back last year in 2020.
Make America great again. By the way, they love African American people. They love black people. MAGA loves black people.
I feel like if you have to say that, though, you know what I mean? Like, then.
What was interesting about that was he was setting black people apart from MAGA. So black people are not a part of MAGA, because MAGA loves them. that was an example of like something that anybody else said, something like that, that would be like, you would never forget it. Trump said that and nobody even remembers it. But I remember that Saturday morning. You know, this is when there was all the unrest over the summer. Trump had said when the looting starts, the shooting starts. They were talking about trying to bring in the military. But this was when President Trump was saying he wanted his supporters to come out. And really, it's kind of foreshadowing what happened. So he was seeing all the unrest by the White House. There were reports that he went into a bunker. So his response was, well, I want my supporters to come out here. And so people were like, well, what are you trying to start, a race war? What do you mean you want your supporters to come out and fight Black Lives Matter? And then because people were saying, well, what are you trying to say? You're trying to start a race war. Then his response is, oh, no, I'm not. MAGA loves the black people. And so I'm so weird.
What?
So, I mean, but I remember talking to my editor, who is black, you know, and both of us being like, our brains were kind of fried. Like, we just couldn't believe what we were hearing. And I went back and listened to it a bunch of times. Did he say the black people? Because I want to make sure. So I'm like, well, let me go back and listen a few. Like, it just kind of, it blew. I think for both of us, it was just like, what is going on in this world? You laugh at it because it's so ridiculous, but it was always sinister. Like, looking at it now, even then, it was, you know, this very serious moment. But looking at what happened on the 6th, you can even see the seeds of it in that, this idea that I'm going to call my supporters out, and then they're going to show you guys what's going on. Yep. It's been there, and it's been building.
More Aisha after the break.
It's only so many black women in that space, and we all know each other. And those insults that he did, it felt like he was going down the line.
Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Squarespace. Kickstart or update written content on any website, product description, or email with Squarespace AI, generating instant personalized results that know and show your brand identity. Explain what your site is about, choose your tone, and enter what you need to get short or long form text. No matter the placement, Squarespace AI makes it easier to go live, stand out, and succeed online. Use code CODESWITCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
The day's top headlines, local stories from your community, your next podcast binge listen. You can have it all in one place, your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
President Biden campaigned on uniting the country. He now takes office just weeks after a pro-Trump insurrection. The NPR Politics podcast is there every day to break down the transition of power as Biden takes the reins in Washington.
Jean.
Shireen.
Code Switch.
And we're back with NPR's White House correspondent, Aisha Roscoe.
The last time you came on the podcast on Code Switch, you spent months like going through all of Donald Trump's tweets. Which one? You're a masochist. Thank you for doing that for us. You're such a brave person. You were cataloging specifically the ways that Trump was talking about, you know, black political figures. People, you know, generally knew that he was tweeting racist stuff, right? Everyone knew that. So why, looking back on it, like, why was it so important for you to get into the specifics of the texture of his tweets?
So, and that's something I've been thinking about a lot now, and that I feel, I don't want to say justified, but I do feel like that was important work. The mm-hmm. reason why I felt like it needed to be done is because I felt like Trump said so many things, and he did it with such frequency that people quickly would forget, or it became just kind of like background noise, or people would just go, oh, well, he talks about everybody. But when you actually sit down and you look at his tweets, you realize he doesn't just talk about everybody in the same way. Eric Swalwell in the House, a Democrat, would always be talking about Trump, saying all sorts of stuff. And he never really got that many tweets from Trump, maybe got like one or two, because that wasn't the person who he wanted to elevate. Mm-hmm. Who he wanted to elevate as his opponent were black women, Maxine Waters. Mm-hmm. He wanted to elevate the squad, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, and, you know, Rashida Tlaib. He wanted to elevate them. Nancy Pelosi, a woman. He wants to elevate certain people, and he will go after them in certain ways. Like, you know, he might go after Robert Mueller, who was investigating him for the things that he did, but he didn't go after him for his intelligence. But the people that he called stupid were, a lot of times, they were people of color. So Maxine Waters would be low IQ. In the midterms, out of all the candidates that he talked about, the Democrats, the only one that he called incompetent was Stacey Abrams when she was running for governor. But the only way you know that is you have to go through all the tweets, because otherwise mm-hmm. it's all just noise and you think, oh, he's just talking about everybody. No, he didn't call anybody else incompetent. The only one who he called incompetent and didn't have enough experience, I don't know if she has what it takes, is Stacey Abrams.
We talked about how much dehumanizing language Trump used against people of color, specifically and women of color, on the podcast. And it felt like that story just kind of came and went. And you mentioned in the answer to this question that you feel justified in cataloging his tweets because it really showed something very specific about him and his racism. Do you feel like your colleagues were as concerned about that as you were about Trump's racism?
I never had people necessarily push back on me wanting to talk about things. There were times where I think sometimes people might be a little bit like, are we going to say this is because he's racist? Is this racism too? Mm-hmm. You know, people were a little like, are we bringing race into this too? Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's been an evolution in the way that people look at Trump especially in the beginning, where I think just in general as an industry, there were people who just felt like, well, yeah, is everything really about race here? Yeah, maybe Trump just says things. He doesn't really mean it that way. You know, and this very clear thing, well, we don't want to make the people that support Trump feel like just because they support him, this has anything to do with race. And I do think over time you've seen this shift where people realize, oh, no, this is all about race. And, you know, there used to be those the defense of the idea that, well, people that voted for Trump, they couldn't be motivated by race because some of them also voted for Obama. Which to me was always a silly talking point. It never made sense as someone who lives in the U.S. and knows that race has never been that simple. It's never been that, you know, people, you can vote for a black man. That doesn't mean that you're not motivated by race. Like, you can have, you know, your black friend over. You can have your, you know, the person raising your children can be black. You love that person, but you still don't like the mother black people. So this is always been a part of it, right?
I agree with you on that point, but I feel like that evolution you brought up has been really slow.
Yes, yes.
It feels like almost that some people waited till January 6th to go, okay, maybe this was about race.
Well, they have a Confederate flag, so maybe this isn't just about heritage.
And they
heritage.
Busted into the Capitol with guns.
Yes. I do think it's been slow. Like, I think it's been slow. And the thing is, maybe the media or certain people in the media did not get it, but his followers always got it. They knew what he was saying. They knew, you know, they could make... They filled in the dots. They knew exactly what he's saying when he's saying Maxine Waters is low IQ. They know exactly what he was saying when he was saying those football players shouldn't kneel and calling them SOBs. They knew exactly what language he was using and what message he was trying to send forth.
Yeah, I did this piece ahead of the 2016 election from Montana. Remember that one, Gene?
Yep.
I interviewed pro-Trump people in Montana, Aisha, and they were believing all kinds of conspiracy theories about terrorists coming to their rural towns because of refugee resettlement.
Sharia law goes against our constitution, goes against the laws of our land. It's being practiced in 20 states in this country. They want to convert us. Or they want to kill us.
And I remember being scared, and I mentioned this to colleagues who were like, oh, there's nothing to be worried about. That's a fringe element. They've always been there. You know, they were totally shrugging it off. And I look back now and I think, man, my gut to be that scared was right. Like, I should have trusted my gut.
Yeah, you know, I think the create, you know, when you create this alternate reality and people really have bought into it. And they've been buying into it. And it's always what's interesting now is that back then the bad guys were the terrorists coming over the border or whatever. And then it became, you know, it's just basically the left and the liberals and the cities and Antifa and Black Lives Matter.
Right.
Like, that's where it ended at. It ended with the cities where they have all this unrest. It's going to come to where we're at. Basically, the black and brown people are going to come in here and they're going to take us over.
Aisha, as you know quite well, during Trump's time in office, he became known for verbally harassing the media in general, but particularly black women reporters. If you don't mind, we're going to play a little bit of a low light reel of Trump harassing black women reporters. It starts with Yamiche Alcindor from PBS asking a question, and we're also going to hear from CNN's Abby Phillip in this.
Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that the president. It's such a racist question.
There are some people that say that now.
What a stupid question that is. But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions. The reason, the same thing with April Ryan. I mean, you talk about somebody that's a loser. She doesn't know what the hell.
So what was it like reporting on a president who has been called out over and over again for his horrible comments about black women?
You know, it was tough. Like, I never caught it the way those reporters, you know, I had towards the end, you know, I asked a question that Trump didn't like and he got an attitude with me. But I never got it the way they did and never to that extent. But being a Black woman in that space and like when he was talking mad at Yamiche over that white nationalist question, I was sitting right beside Yamiche after that happened. Mm. And, you know, obviously I know her. She's a friend. And I remember just like doing the what you do in those situations when it was done, like you did good. You did a good job. You asked a great question. That's what I told her. And I obviously know April Ryan, Abby Phillips. You know, there are only so many Black women, and we all know each other. And it's only so many Black women in that space. And those insults that he did, they happened in a space of time right after the midterms. And so it felt like he was going down the line. You know, it was like, well, who is next? Like, it's only like, you know, so many of us for him to attack. And there were times, you know, obviously, I don't catch it. Like I said, I haven't had death threats like other people have had. But when I did that story on him, you know, the way he talked about Black people, and I said that Trump was calling Maxine Waters low IQ, someone tweeted at me, well, she is low IQ, and so are you. You're low IQ, too, and you can't talk, and, you know, the way you speak, and da-da-da-da. I mean, they were using the same, you know, the same language against me. And so those same attacks are turned back around. And so it has, I think in some ways, obviously it has taken a toll. It has been a lot. You know, I won't dismiss that it hasn't been a weight. It has been a weight.
Hmm.
Remind us what he did to you, because I remember that being on social media.
He got mad at a question that I did, and this was during the coronavirus. President Trump... I asked him a question. I think this was at some point where we had reached another milestone in deaths. He had done an event and everybody was just, you know, sitting around talking about what a great job they had done responding to the coronavirus. And so I asked the question, like, you're taking credit for these things that you say have gone right.
You want credit for what the government has done.
Do you take any responsibility for, you know, however many thousand people had died at that point? And he answered,
minimal numbers were going to be 100,000 people.
But then after that, you could tell he was upset. And then when I tried to ask a follow up later on or ask another question later on,
Mr. President,
he went, oh, wait. Does anybody else have a question?
Hold it 1 second. Any other questions from any other people?
No.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're done.
Everybody.
Like, it was just like a power play. Like, I'm like, you not get another question. And like, but it was never anything like on the level of other people. But he did get an attitude with me. But you could see how quickly it shifts and how quickly you become the person who is under attack for some reason.
So, and I'm just curious about what you make of this, the way we cover politics, right? Like, one of the things that happens in the news media, particularly around sort of partisan politics, is we cover things. So Democrats want this and Republicans want this. And you could see there's always been like a lot of limitations to both like what that means for like American political discourse. But I think we saw that really clearly during the Trump administration was that a lot of stuff that he was doing and the response to that stuff was sort of framed as like partisan fighting, right?
Yeah.
Like, I was curious what you think of what we should do with that framing going forward, because it seems like talking about these things as Democrat and Republican problems or Democrat and Republican disagreements sort of flattens all of the other dimensions of the stuff that was happening during the Trump administration.
It does. And I think that this has been an issue that the media is definitely still trying to grapple with, because there were obviously at time there were false equivalents, right? Like, there were this, you know, these weren't necessarily like fights over like, are we gonna raise taxes or lower taxes? These were just like fights over like, what is actual reality? You know, there was no comparison. Like, you couldn't go like, well, Trump called Omarosa Manigault Newman a dog, but Nancy Pelosi said, I want, you know, to tax people who make more money. Like, they're two totally different. Like, you can't, like, do what, there's no, it's not the same. Like, the language is just not the same, right? Like, and it's not, like, a bias to say it. It's just a fact. Like, it's just not, it's not the same. And I think we've seen that play out and that it's not the same. And so I think that at a certain point, it is not objective to have someone over here, like, you know, saying all sorts of things, not playing by any of the rules, you know, not doing any of the, and then try to say, well, but people on the other side don't tie their shoes sometimes. It's not that is not objectivity. And I think that people have to come to terms with that. Like, it's not being objective to say, well, they both do the same thing when they're not doing the same thing.
This podcast episode is going to drop on the last day of the Trump presidency. What do you think are going to be the lasting effects of all of this chaos, especially when it comes to talking about race?
Yeah. The lasting effect on this country, I think there is obviously just, it's not something that Trump came up with, racism and white supremacy. That's not something that he came up with, but that is something that white grievance that he played upon and that he intuitively knew was something that he could ride to the top of the U.S. power structure. And that's what he did. Mm-hmm. And that the way that he did that and the way that he went about that, I think that that has changed. It's changed the way politicians talk about each other, the things that they're willing to say about each other. And it's not about just trying to be polite, but when you start talking about people as enemies and as stupid, it ends up with violence because you're making people be less than human. And so I think that opening that door to politicians being more willing to say those things is something that I think we will be feeling the effects of for a long time. And I do think it's damaging. I do hope that that slow evolution we talked about with the media kind of having the scales fall off their eyes when it comes to race and seeing that these are real issues, I hope that that continues and hopefully escalates and goes faster than it's been going. I do hope that that continues and that people realize that that anger and all those things that drove these people to the Capitol with, you know, Confederate flags, with white supremacist, you know, anti-Semitic t-shirts, and that all of these things have been building in this country for a very long time, and that we need to not act as if those things don't exist.
Or they're fringe.
Or they're fringe, because they're very mainstream, right? They're very mainstream. So that's what my hope is. I don't know what exactly happens, though. And I will say, too, that Trump leaves with a black woman, a woman of color, as vice president coming into office. He leaves with, you know, Stacey Abrams elevated after he called her incompetent, with two Democrats coming from Georgia to be in the Senate. So he leaves with people that he spoke out against elevated. And yeah, you know, and a lot of the black women reporters that he went against are also doing very well. Yamiche Alcindor, Abby Phillips, April Ryan. So, you know, I don't know exactly what to say. You can't keep a good woman down. So, you know, I don't know. But I mean, so yes, that is also a part of the legacy of, like, you know, he said and did all those things, but a lot of people have still, you know, been able to do great things in all of that.
That was NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe reflecting on her past 4 years that she spent covering the Trump administration. And y'all, that is our show. We made it, y'all. All of us. We made it to the end of this era.
Yes, we made it. And as a nation, we are likely to be dissecting the lasting effects of this administration for decades to come.
Goody.
As a team, the Code Switch team, we're also going to take some time to think about this next phase of American history that we're getting into. What big issues will get new light under the Biden-Harris administration? What do we need to dig into deeper, regardless of who's in office? And who are the artists and activists and cultural leaders we need to be paying more attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And what role will COVID play in all this?
Oh my God, yeah.
Hopefully not one for too much longer. It's a lot.
It's a lot. So we're going to spend the next few weeks reporting and reflecting and processing. And we want to hear from y'all. So tell us what stories you think we need to be telling. Who should we be talking to? Email us at codeswitch@npr.org with the subject line Race in 2021 to let us know.
And you can follow us on Twitter or IG. Remember, we're at NPR Code Switch.
And subscribe to our newsletter, which is very, very dope. You can find our newsletter at npr.org/codeswitchnewsletter.
This episode was produced by Kumari Devarajan and edited by Leah Donella. It was fact-checked by Natalie Escobar and our new intern, Summer Tomad.
Welcome, Summer. And a shout-out to the rest of the Code Switch Massive. You got Karen Grigsby Bates. You got Jess Kung. You got Alyssa Jong Perry. You got L.A. Johnson. And, of course, Steve Drummond.
Who are you?
I am Jean Dempy.
Who and are you? And I am Shireen Marisol Meraji.
Y'all be easy.
Peace. On that tip, I'm definitely looking forward to watching Sonia Sotomayor swear in Kamala Harris, because that's history right there.
Yes.
You know, a Puerto Rican Supreme Court justice swearing in a Black and Asian woman vice president. I get emotional thinking about that.
It's a big deal, and I know Jean will appreciate this. She is, you know, she's a Howard.
I knew it was coming. I'm surprised we got this far. Okay.
She is, you know, Kamala Harris is a Howard grad. So it's someone, an HBCU, and someone, you know, from Howard University, the Mecca, which I also graduated from. And so that there's
did
also
you know?
That,
that.
Did you know that? That? Did you know that?
I did not know that.
As soon as you wake up, you need the latest. That's why Up First is here. It's NPR's morning news podcast. In just 10 minutes or so, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Get the service you deserve. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.